Hello, everyone. It's a wonderful thing to be at the Feast of Tabernacles with the children of God, which we all are. The Feast of Tabernacles is always to be an uplifting time when we could worship with exuberance. Each of us has a unique experience as to what caused us to have faith. But faith is also a gift. It's a gift of God. He helps us to have faith through various experiences that we have. And we each are unique, and we each have unique experiences that bring us to God. I have somewhat of a different experience because I grew up in a Jewish household. And Jewish parents teach Jewish children to avoid Christianity. There's a prejudice against Christianity. And for a Jew to accept Jesus and Christianity, they have to go through an experience that's different from other people who don't have that prejudice. And what does it is seeing Jesus in the Old Testament. That's what does it. In other words, a book is involved. The Bible is involved. That's a very significant thing, because what we believe is an outcome of looking at the Scriptures, looking at the Bible. And faith is also a matter of not only the inspiration that comes to help us from God to see Jesus, but it also is, because it's based upon a book, we have the Word. There's two words. We have the book as the Word, the written book, but we also have the Logos, the Word, which is Jesus. And so Jesus helps us to be able to understand the book. It is as it is written in Luke chapter 24 and verses 44 and 45. It says, "Then he," speaking about Jesus, "said to them, 'These are the words which I spoke to you while I was with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses, and in the prophets, and in the Psalms concerning me.' And he opened their understanding." He opened their understanding that they might understand the Scriptures. And that had to do with the Scriptures pointing to him. And some of them were not obvious. He had to open their understanding so that they would understand what the Scriptures had to say. I want to go to John chapter 20 and verse 30 and verse 31. It says there, "And truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these," now he specially chose certain things to tell them, "these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ," and the word Christ means Messiah, the promised Messiah from the Scriptures of the Old Testament, "that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." Now there's an interesting phrase, believe what? Two things, it says. Two things. The first is that Jesus is the Messiah. But it adds the Son of God. It adds the Son of God. Now, that's a very important expression, the Son of God. He adds that when he wrote, that you believe two things, that he's the Messiah, but also that he is the Son of God. Now, I want to go to 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13. He repeats a same phrase. These things I have written to you. He particularly chose certain things there. These things I have written to you who believe in the name of the Son of God. He again uses that phrase, the Son of God. Who believe in the name of the Son of God. Now, when it says who believe in the name of the Son of God, it doesn't mean in a pronunciation label, so to speak. A name like we speak of Jim or Mike or somebody else. It's not speaking about a name of a pronunciation of a person. But the name of the Son of God, it means the character of the Son of God, the nature of the Son of God, what the Son of God is, who the Son of God is. That's what it means. The word in both Greek and Hebrew for name means a whole lot more than a pronunciation label. It means the nature and character of that. And it's the nature and character of the Son of God. Who is the Son of God? What does that mean? And continuing in 1 John 5:13, that you may know that you have eternal life and that you may believe in the name of the Son of God. And the title of the message for today is Believing in the Name of the Son of God. Believing in the name of the Son of God. That's what I'm going to talk about today. I want to read John 11 and verse 27. John 11 verse 27 is in the context is when Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. A great miracle and a witness to the people. Because Jesus said, I am the resurrection. And he was going to show them that he was the resurrection by raising Lazarus from the dead. And he's speaking and he's talking to Martha. And Martha responds in John 11, 27. And Martha said to him, to Jesus, Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God. Who has come into the world. And so she also knew from the teaching that Jesus had given over a period of years already. Not only to say that Jesus is the Messiah, but she, out of her own lips, said, The Son of God, I believe that you are the Son of God. And so what I'd like to do today is to go through the Old Testament scriptures that speak of the Son of God so that we may comprehend what he would have taught the disciples. He taught them before the New Testament was written. He taught them when all they had was the Old Testament. That's when he taught them. No New Testament was written yet. And so when they said, as Martha said here, I believe in the name of the Son of God, or I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God. What did she mean when she said, I believe the Son of God, that you are the Son of God? He taught them, he taught Martha, he taught the others. And so that's what I want to do. There are eight places in the Old Testament in which it speaks of the Son of God. And so we're going to see some of the depth of what Jesus would have taught his own disciples about believing in the Son of God, who the Son of God was. And so that is the core of the message for today, going through eight places in the Old Testament where it discusses the Son of God, and we are said to have to believe that he is the Son of God, and the belief comes from what it says in the Old Testament. And that's what we're going to discuss today. And I've ordered them in a specific order. It's not going to come in the order in which the Old Testament is written, but I specifically chose the order in which to bring out these eight different scriptures of the Old Testament that discusses the Son of God. First, I want to go to Psalm chapter 2, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 9. Psalm chapter 2, 1 through 9. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? Vain means an evil, worthless thing. The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together. It makes me think of the United Nations in some sense. Against the Lord and against his anointed. Now, the word anointed means Messiah. That's what it means. So against the Lord and against his Messiah is what it's saying. So it's talking about the Messiah at some point when the nations gather together to fight. Let us break their cords to pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. That is the nations that gather together. He shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Now we've spoken about the word anointed Messiah already. And now we're going to speak about other titles of the Messiah, other ways of referring to the Messiah. Starting in verse 6. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill, the hill of Zion, my holy hill of Zion. Zion is the high point of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is about 2,500 feet above sea level. And Zion is a few hundred feet above that. It's a little bit higher than that. Zion is the high point of Jerusalem. And he calls that my holy hill of Zion. And the king in the future coming down to rule is Jesus, who is the Messiah in this context. Verse 7, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, and the me is the Messiah, you are my son. You are my son. And we're talking today about what it means to be the Son of God. And so this is talking about the Son of God. And it says to the Messiah, you are my son. Today you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth for your possession. So this is referring to a time in the future when Jesus comes back in power as king. And the title Son is mentioned. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. And so we see the first context. The first context is a prophetic. It's in the future. It's a title of the Messiah prophetically. Prophetic title of world rulership as king. So this particular passage shows a time when the nations are defeated by the king. It's a prophetic time of world rulership as king that the title Son brings out. The title Son brings out world rulership as king. Now I want to go to the second passage using the word Son, the Son of God. Psalm 72. I'm going to read verses 1 through 15. Psalm 72. It says, a Psalm of Solomon. Now, when it says a Psalm of Solomon, he is the son of David. So when you begin reading this, you think that maybe It's talking about David and Solomon. Starts out with that kind of a thought because Solomon wrote this. And so let's see what happens here in Psalm 72, verse 1. I'm continuing. Give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son. Now, Solomon is writing this. He is the king's son. He's David's son. He will judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. Now, King Solomon had a dream, and he was given the opportunity to ask for something. And he asked for great wisdom. And he was given the gift of wisdom in that dream that he requested. He was told his request would be honored. He didn't ask for riches. He asked for wisdom. And he brought justice in a sense. So when it says in verse 2, you're poor with justice, he was, in a sense, fulfilling that because he did have wisdom and he did bring justice. It says in verse 3, the mountains will bring peace to the people. And the little hills by righteousness. He will bring justice to the poor of the people. He will save the children of the needy. And will break in pieces the oppressor. They shall fear you as long as the sun and the moon endure throughout all generations. Well, all of a sudden, in that verse that we just read, verse 5, it suddenly goes beyond the realm of David and Solomon, King David and his son Solomon, who became king. Because it says, they shall fear you as long as the sun and moon endure throughout all generations. You can't say that about King David, and you can't say that about King Solomon, unless you're referring to the resurrection in the far future. So it's suddenly, who is the subject here? It says, give the king in verse 1 your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son. So there's a new dimension brought out over here of who the king is and who the son is. Because you could think of the king as being God the Father and the son as being Jesus. And as we go on, we'll see that kind of a way of understanding verse 1 is brought out in fullness. Continuing now in verse 6. He shall come down like rain upon the grass before mowing, like showers that water the earth. In his days the righteous shall flourish, an abundance of peace until the moon is no more. In other words, forever and ever. So it's talking about this one that comes down, and the one that comes down in the return to fight and bring about world peace is Jesus. And he's called in verse 1, the Son. He is King and Son in verse 1. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Those who dwell in the wilderness will bow before him. So we're not supposed to bow before mere people, but we bow before the King of Kings. We bow before the returning Messiah. We bow before Jesus. And so this is talking about the Messiah in the future when he reigns and brings about world peace, who is called in verse 1, the Son. He is the Son of God because the King in verse 1 is God, and it talks about the King's Son. And the king's son is Jesus. So this is a psalm about the Son of God. Verse 10. Well, verse 9, I think we finished only half of it. Let me read verse 9 again. Those who dwell in the wilderness will bow before him, and his enemies will lick the dust. They will be defeated, at that end time battle before world peace. The kings of Tarshish and of the isles will bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba will offer gifts. Yes, all kings shall fall down before him. All nations shall serve him. For he will deliver the needy when he cries, the poor also, and him who has no helper. He will spare the poor and needy, and will save the souls of the needy. He will redeem their life from oppression and violence, and precious shall be their blood in his sight. And he shall live, and the gold of Sheba will be given to him. Prayer also will be made for him continually. We will be engaged as now praying for him, for Jesus, the Son of God. And daily he shall be praised. Daily he shall be praised. And so this adds to the prophetic rulership of the world with justice. So this psalm brings about the truth about the Son of God. It's a prophetic rulership of the entire world with justice. That's what this psalm brings about. Prophetic rulership of the entire world with justice, with peace, with peace. Now I want to go to a third place where the Son is mentioned. We're going to go to Zechariah chapter 12 and read verses 4 through 10. Zechariah chapter 12. See, what we're trying to do now is to explain the places, eight places in the Old Testament where the Son is mentioned to bring out the fullness of what the Old Testament teaches about the Son of God. Because, as Martha said, I believe you are the Son of God. And she knew something from that. And we're going to see the expansive nature of what the Son of God means from the Old Testament. So let's go to Zechariah chapter 12, beginning in verse 4. Got to find the verse number I want to start out with. In that day, so it's a future time, says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion. So this is going to be a miraculous battle because the armies are going to come against Jerusalem. And the Messiah will come down. And he's going to strike every horse with confusion. And its rider with madness. I will open my eyes upon the house of Judah. Because today's Israel should be called Judah. It's the house of Judah. The house of Israel was taken captive by Assyria. And the northern 10 tribes were spread out across. And they're the lost 10 tribes. And what was left was the southern kingdom, the house of Judah. And the nation called Israel today should really be called the house of Judah. And so this is speaking truthfully about the end time and what the modern nation of Israel should be called, the house of Judah. So it says, I will open my eyes on the house of Judah. And will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength, and the Lord of hosts, their God. And that day I will make the governors of Judah like a firepan in the woodpile, and like a fiery torch in the sheaves. In other words, the returning Messiah is going to strengthen Judah against all of the armies around the world that come against it. They shall devour all the surrounding peoples on the right hand and on the left. But Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, Jerusalem. The Lord will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall not become greater than that of Judah. In that day, the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David. And the house of David shall be like God, like the messenger of Yahweh before them. It shall be on that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they, and the day of the Jews, the Jews that are still alive at that time in that battle, they will look upon me, whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him. Their eyes will be opened. They will mourn for him. Tears will come down in mourning, as one mourns for his only son. For his only son. And there we see the Son of God, the only Son, as a title of Messiah, the only Son, and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn. In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad Ramon in the plain of Megiddo. Now, so we see that the Jews' eyes will be opened, and then they will finally recognize who the Messiah is. Who the Messiah is. And it says, they have pierced. In other words, they agreed when the high priest said to the people, to incite them to the crucifixion, they said, crucify! The mob shouted out, crucify! And so that's why it says, whom they pierced. And so we see the beauty of the Son of God in recognition in this context. He's called the only Son who they pierced, who they were responsible for the crucifixion. The crucifixion is what it's referring to. And he's referring to as the only Son, the only Son. And it's true that we are also sons of God. We are children of God. But he is called the only Son. Special, the only Son, as the title here, the Son of God. And so it brings out the prophetic nature in terms of the future from the standpoint of Zechariah, because Zechariah wrote this before the first coming of Jesus. Before the first coming of Jesus, he wrote this. And now I want to go to Amos chapter 8 and read verses 9 and 10. Amos chapter 8, verses 9 and 10. And it shall come to pass in that day, it's a day in the future, a day in the future from the standpoint of Amos. It shall come to pass in that day, says Yahweh Almighty, that I will make the sun go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in broad daylight. And indeed, that's prophetic of what happened when Jesus died. At noon, there was darkness on the face of the earth for 3 hours, is what it says in Matthew and Mark and Luke. There was darkness on the face of the earth for 3 hours. That I will make the sun go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your feasts into mourning, and all your songs with lamentation. I will bring sackcloth on every waist and baldness on every head. I will make it like mourning for an only son. Mourning for an only son. And its end like a bitter day. What this is doing is bringing in two aspects of what would happen in the future from the time of Amos. The first is what would happen on the day of the crucifixion. Mourning for an only son. See, the followers mourned for him. The disciples, the 12 that he taught, except for Judas, the 11 that were left, they mourned for him in the crucifixion. His mother mourned for him in the crucifixion. They mourned for him as an only son. But verse 10 follows up and what happened in the destruction of Jerusalem when the Romans came and they burned the city and destroyed the temple. So it's mixing two things, the crucifixion and the destruction of Jerusalem that would happen in the year 70. And so we see that fourth context of the Son. And it's really prophetic of the death of the Messiah and the destruction of Jerusalem that followed the crucifixion. Now I want to go to the fifth place. The fifth place where the Son is mentioned. Let's go to the first book of the Bible, Genesis. I want to go to Genesis chapter 22. And I'm going to start in verse 2. God said to Abraham in verse 2, take now your son, your only son. Your only son. Just exactly what we read in two different places. We read it in Zechariah 12. Your only son, who you pierced, mourned for him as an only son. And we also read it in Amos, your only son. That phrase, only son, occurs five times in the Old Testament. All five times, it's referring to the Son of God. One of those five times that we read was in Zechariah 12, only son. Then we read it in Amos, only son. And there's three more times that the phrase only son occurs. And it's in Genesis 22. Genesis 22. He said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship. And we will come back to you. Isn't that wonderful? Abraham said, we will come back to you. He was told to offer up his only son. And he said to the young men, you stay here. I don't want you to see what's going to happen. He said, we will come back to you. Isn't that interesting? We will come back to you. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife. And the two of them went together. In other words, Isaac was carrying the wood. And Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father? And he said, here I am, my son. Then he said, look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, well, God will provide. And in the translation, it says for himself, but the word for is not there in the Hebrew. The word for is not there in the Hebrew. It says, God will provide himself the lamb. God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood on the altar in a wooden order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him upon the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the messenger of Yahweh called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son. That's the second time only son appears in Genesis 22. Your only son, which is the title of the Messiah, your only son from me. Then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, in the mouth of Yahweh it shall be provided. Verse 15. Then the messenger of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Third time, only son. Blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed, and the seed, really, according to Galatians, was referring to Christ, the Messiah. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And so we see that this was the type of the Messiah. The Messiah was the Lamb who substituted. The Lamb was a substitute for us in our pains and our sorrows and our hurts. And for our salvation, he was a substitute for us. And just as the ram was a substitute. But the only son in this context goes back to the other two places we read before in Zechariah and Amos, referring to as a type of the Messiah. And so this whole episode shows the idea that God could slay a person who is a righteous person, Isaac as a type of the Messiah. So there's a lot of type and anti-type in Genesis 22, speaking of the only son, which is the Son of God. Now I want to go to the sixth place where the son is mentioned, and that's in Proverbs 30 in verse 4. Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 4. It says there, who has ascended into heaven or descended? Who? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who can do that? Who has bound the waters in a garment? That's like the clouds. Who can form the clouds? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name? And what is his son's name, if you know? What is his son's name? That's an interesting thing to say. And this is talking about God and the Son of God. God and the Son of God. What is his name? Now, when it says, what is his name, it's not asking, how do you pronounce a word, a label? It's not talking about a pronunciation label. In other words, when it says, what is his son's name, it means, what is his nature? What is he like? Who is he? That's what it's asking. It's not asking for some one-word label to attach to him, a pronunciation label. What's he like? What is his son like? Is asking that question. What is his son like? And the answer will come in the seventh place that the Son of God is mentioned. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 9 and read verses 6 and 7. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. It says, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Ah, a son is given. Now notice, given. A son is given. In other words, he's given for the whole world. He's given for us. He's given for us. He's given. A son is given. And the government will be upon his shoulder. In other words, he's going to be a ruler. This son is going to be a ruler. And his name will be called. Now, remember, Proverbs 34 said, what is his name? What is the name of the son? And this is going to tell you what the name of the son is right here. And his name will be called. So this is answering the question given in Proverbs 30, verse 4. Proverbs 34, it said, what is his name? It says here what his name is. His name will be called. In other words, his nature and character is this. This is his nature and character we're going to read here. The first of the, there's five words, descriptions, five descriptions here, his nature and character. The first of them is wonderful. Wonderful. That's his first thing, wonderful. Now, in order to understand wonderful, we're going to go to Judges 13 and then come back here. So I'm going to put a little marker in my Bible so it'll make it easier to come back. And I'm going to go to Judges 13 beginning in verse 8. Judges 13, verse 8. Now, this is the incident when the birth of Samson was predicted. Manoah and his wife, the parents of Samson before he was born. Judges chapter 13. And we're going to start in verse 8 instead of reading the entire chapter. It says, then Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, O my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born. In other words, he told his wife, who was barren in old age, you're going to have a child. And God listened to the voice of Manoah. And the messenger of God, not angel, there's a word, malach, in the Hebrew. And the word malach can mean messenger or angel. Many, many times it means messenger, a human messenger. But it could also be translated angel. And so the translation put in angel, but I believe we should translate it messenger, not angel. And we'll see why. And the messenger of God came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, "Look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me." So Manoah arose and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to this woman?" And he said, "I am." Manoah said, "Now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?" So he wanted to know what is going to happen with this child to be born. So the messenger of Yahweh said to Manoah, "Of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine," it's talking about the grapevine, "nor shall she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I commanded, let her observe." In other words, he is going to be of a Nazarite vow, not to eat any grapes, nothing that comes from the vine. So Manoah said to the messenger of the Lord, "Please, let us detain you, and we will prepare a young goat for you." And the messenger of the Lord said to Manoah, "Though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to the Lord." For Manoah did not know he was the messenger of the Lord. See, that was hidden from him. Manoah did not know that he was the messenger of Yahweh. Then Manoah said to the messenger of Yahweh, "What is your name?" Oh, a very interesting question. "What is your name that when your words come to pass, we may honor you?" And the messenger of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask my name? It is wonderful." Now the translation says, "Seeing, it is wonderful." The word "seeing" is not in the Hebrew. The word "seeing" is not in the Hebrew. "Why do you ask my name? It is wonderful." Now that word "wonderful" we just read in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. The first of the descriptions of the Son, the name, the character, the nature of the Son is wonderful. Jesus is wonderful. And he said, "Why do you ask my name? It is wonderful." And it's really the same word in the Hebrew, wonderful, as it is in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 5. Wonderful. It's a slightly different part of speech. And when the Strong's numbers were put on words, even if it was a little different part of speech, they gave it a different number. But it's really the same word, wonderful. And so this messenger of Yahweh said, "Why do you ask my name? It is wonderful." Now, what this reminds me is that John chapter 8, verse 58. I'm going to read John 8, 58 for the moment. Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." In other words, he preexisted before he was born as the Son. He preexisted before he was born as the Son. And the messenger of Yahweh said, "Why do you ask my name? It is wonderful." And what this is teaching us, this is teaching about the Son of God, that he existed before he was born as the Son. Because the messenger of the, and let's continue reading now. Let's continue reading now in verse 19 of Judges 13. So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to Yahweh. And he said, and he did a wondrous thing. Wondrous, it's the same Hebrew word as wonderful. It's a slightly different part of speech, but it's the same stem, same word. Wonderful. He did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar. The miraculous flame came down from the altar. And the messenger of Yahweh ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. In other words, they realized he wasn't just a man. When the messenger of Yahweh appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the messenger of Yahweh. And Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." We have seen God. And his wife said to him, "No, we're not going to die." Because he wouldn't have said all those things. "My son hasn't been born yet, so we're not going to die." But this is an interesting thing, because it points out the word "wonderful" shows not only a miracle maker, but it also shows this pre-existence. Because of the use of the Hebrew word "wonderful" back in Judges chapter 13. So that is showing his nature as being a miracle performer, and his pre-existence. Now going back to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. I said verse 5, but I meant to say verse 6, Isaiah 9, verse 6. After "wonderful," the next word is "counselor." Counselor. Now, what is a counselor? A counselor is one who gives you truthful advice. And especially if it's advice from above. Counselor is the one who reveals things. That's what it is. The counselor is one who reveals truth. And I'm going to read one passage from the New Testament showing the revelation of truth. John, I'm going to read chapter 16, verses 12 through 15. John 16, 12 through 15, because we're going to see the true counselor here. "I still have many more things to say to you," Jesus said to his disciples, "but you cannot bear them now. I can't tell you everything because you're not capable mentally to bear some things that I can't tell you right now. However, when the Spirit of truth has come, he will guide you into all truth. For he will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will tell you things to come." So there will be a revelation, a counselor. "He will glorify me," Jesus, "for he will take of what is mine and declare it to you. All things that the Father has are mine. Therefore, I said, he will take of mine and declare it to you." And Jesus is the counselor. The Son is the counselor. So we go back to Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. The second thing, the second characteristic, the second nature of the Son is counselor, the one who reveals things. In other words, the role of the Holy Spirit, mentioned in John chapter 16, the role of the Holy Spirit, counselor. And so that is the second character, the name of the Son given here, wonderful counselor. And now I want to go to the third item mentioned about the Son of God in Isaiah 9, verse 6. Mighty God! So this is a clear statement that the Son of God would be God. From the Old Testament, the Son of God would be God. And so the Jews are blinded. This says the Son of God, his nature, his character, is mighty God. That's what Martha knew. when he said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of God." So we're talking about believing on the Son of God, that he is God. This is telling us from the Old Testament, Jesus is God, without even going into the New Testament. And the next item that specifies his nature, it says, "Everlasting Father." Now that is a mystery. That is a mystery to say "Everlasting Father." And I'm not going to speak at length about that because I'll say, honestly, there's a lot of controversy over how to understand that. I'm not going to get into that kind of controversy. But all I'm going to do is quote one scripture from the New Testament that Jesus said, and said this in John chapter 10 and verse 30. John 10, verse 30, he said, "The Father and I are one." He said, "The Father and I are one." And I'm not going to say any more than that. I'm just going to leave it at that. "Everlasting Father" is what it says. And then the last item it says, and this verse 6 is, "The Prince of Peace." The Prince of Peace. And that will be in the future. In the future, when he comes back and brings about world peace, he will be the Prince of Peace. And so all of these beautiful five statements indicate the nature of the Son of God, prophetically. The nature of the Son of God, all of these five things, his preexistence, that he was God. He's the Prince of Peace. He's wonderful. He's a miracle worker. All of these things the Son of God is. From the Old Testament. And now, verse 7. "Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, and to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." It's certain. And now I want to go to the eighth place. The eighth place where the Son of God is mentioned. The eighth place. Now, I'm going to tell you where it is, and I'm going to give you a little context. We're going to read Isaiah chapter 7, verses 10 through 17. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10 through 17. And the context refers to a king of Judah. The house of Judah, the king of the house of Judah, Ahaz. Ahaz is the king. Now, in the context, Assyria is coming against the house of Judah. And Ahaz is worried that they're going to lose the whole kingdom. Ahaz is worried. And so in the context, through the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah is telling Ahaz, "Don't worry. Your kingdom is not going to be destroyed by Assyria at this point in history. Don't worry about it." And so in verse 10 of Isaiah 7, it says here, I'm going to read now from verse 10. "Moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign." Now, asking a sign means to show, to prove that you don't have to worry about it. Assyria won't defeat you. Assyria won't defeat you. "Ask for a sign. I'll perform whatever you want to prove to you by a sign you won't be defeated by Assyria. Ask for a sign for yourself from the Lord your God." And of course, Isaiah is saying this to King Ahaz. Ask it, either in the depth or the height above. In other words, you can ask for the greatest miracle at all. I don't care how great a miracle you ask, the Lord will do it to show you a sign, a miracle. But Ahaz said, "I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord." I'm not going to test him. I'm not going to ask for a sign. Then he, Isaiah, said, "Hear now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will you weary my God also?" In other words, he's asking for your sign and you're refusing to give a sign. to ask for a sign. You're refusing. Therefore, verse 14, the Lord himself will give you a sign. You're not asking for a sign. Okay, so I'll give you a sign instead. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. A son. This is talking about the Son of God, the eighth place. Son of God is mentioned. The virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name, and the word name again means character, nature, what that son would be like. Emmanuel. And Emmanuel means, it's a Hebrew word, it means God with us. That's what it means, God with us. In other words, that son will be, his name, his character, his nature will be God with us. God with us. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, in other words, before Jesus is born, before that future time, the land that you dread, that's Assyria, will be forsaken by both her kings. In other words, you don't have to worry about Assyria. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house. And Ahaz is the king that's at this time. His son will be Hezekiah after him. So it says, in your father's days, days you have not come since the day that Ephraim refers to the northern 10 tribes of Israel, the northern kingdom, departed from Judah. Okay, the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you, but it won't be in your days. It won't be in your days. It'll be left for the future. Okay, now, the mystery verse here is verse 14, Isaiah 7, verse 14, and it's a very strange one, because I want to tell you what happened in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, the leading Jews, the leading rabbis, were forced by the government to have debates with Christians over Jesus, that he was the Messiah. And the Jews would have debates with the Christians over Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. They would have the debates over that verse. Because the word that is used for virgin does not have to mean virgin, but it can mean virgin. Now, the word in the Hebrew is Alma. Strong's number 5959 for the word virgin in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. It's Alma. In Strong's number 5959, but in Genesis 24, verse 43, I'll say that Genesis chapter 24 and verse 43, Alma does mean virgin. So it can mean virgin, but it doesn't have to mean virgin. And so the question is, what does it mean in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14? Does it mean virgin or not? It can mean, in some contexts it means virgin, in other contexts it doesn't. But in Genesis 24, verse 43, Alma is there, and it does mean virgin there. Why? Because Abraham asked his servant, to go and find a wife for Isaac. To find a wife for Isaac. And so he had to travel some distance to where Abraham grew up in his youth, to find a wife for Isaac. And it says in the previous verse in Genesis 24, verse 16, a woman who has not known a man. In other words, was a virgin. So the context shows that the woman that the servant of Abraham prayed for did not know a man, was a virgin. So the word Alma could mean virgin, but it doesn't have to be virgin. How do we know it means virgin in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14? The answer is this. The answer is this. Sign! Sign! That's the answer. Because it says in verse 11, ask a sign for yourself. I don't care what it is. Could be the depth of the earth or the height of the heavens. A miracle, he's asking. He's asking for a miracle. Now, if it was just an ordinary human birth, it would not be a miracle. If it was an ordinary human birth, it would not be a sign. It wouldn't be a miracle. The word sign in this context is asking for a miracle. So he's saying, I'll give you a miracle. And the miracle would be the virgin birth. If it was just an ordinary birth, it would not be a miracle. And it wouldn't be a sign. So it had to mean virgin because it was a miracle birth. It was a sign. And that's why the word Alma in this context must mean miracle, must be a virgin. Must be a virgin because it was a miracle. It was a sign. And so this beautiful thing about the sun is it shows the virgin birth from the Old Testament. Part of the meaning of the Son of God and having believing in the name of the Son of God is believing the virgin birth. From the Old Testament, without even seeing Matthew chapter 1, verse 23, that quotes this. I'm not going to go to Matthew 1, 23, but it quotes this verse. Speaking of virgin shall conceive. And so I want to now give a summary. Seven pointers that we have seen about the Son of God from the Old Testament that Martha knew when she said, you are the Son of God. One, his preexistence. We've seen that. And we've seen that from the word wonderful. Wonderful. His preexistence in Judges 13, wonderful. His preexistence before he was born as a son. Number two, he is mighty God, Emmanuel. Mighty God, Emmanuel. And so that's the second point of the Son of God. He is God. He is God. The third point was the virgin birth. The virgin birth from Isaiah 7:14. The fourth point is he's made flesh by birth from a woman. He is made flesh by birth from a woman. In other words, it shows the incarnation. The incarnation, which is stated in John 1, verse 14. It says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And he became flesh by being born of a woman. So the incarnation being born flesh is shown in the Old Testament. Not only the virgin birth, but the incarnation being born in flesh. The Word became flesh. God becoming flesh is seen in the Old Testament as part of the nature of the Son of God. The virgin birth. But number four was God made flesh. God made flesh. That's point number four. God made flesh. Point number five. The Son dies as a sacrifice. That's seen from Zechariah 12:10 and Genesis 22 through Isaac as a type. And so the Son will die as a sacrifice. The Son will die as a sacrifice. That's part of what is seen also. And number six, the Son is the King of the world. The Son is the King of the world from Psalm 2 and Psalm 72 and Isaiah 9, verse 7. And the seventh point is the Son is Counselor, the one who reveals things. The one who reveals things. The Son is our Counselor. And so we have seen the panoramic beauty of believing in the Son of God. And so when
we could see with Martha, we could see the depth of these tremendous things that the Old Testament pointed out of the nature of the Messiah as the Son of God. Miraculous things revealed not only in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament. But the Jews were blinded. The Jews were blinded to seeing the depth of the Son of God.